The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill is a broadcast historian in University College Cork, and she spoke to me about the importance history plays in shaping both the present and our future. Shannon Joyce recently launched Daffodil Day for 2020 and talked to me about how she's been coping with her second cancer diagnosis in the space of 5 years. Writer and director Kieran Cassidy told me about his new documentary Jihad Jane, which tells the story of how one of the most absurd terror cells came together and found its way to Waterford. Gordon Goodwin's son Ben goes to a school for children with severe dyslexia. He spoke to me about the important work being done in reading schools and what his own life was like growing up with the reading disorder. And Gabby told me about how discovering love letters that had been written to her grandfather from his old girlfriends gave her insight into a man she never knew. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. Now, thanks for all those texts. We'll get to them in a few minutes. 51551. But I want to talk to UCC's Fionnuala O'Neill Doyle. Good morning to you.
Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill, even.
Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill. Okay. Whatever you're having yourself. It's the curse of the double barrel name. We know it. Which came first?
Let's keep my husband happy. So it was Doyle originally and then Doyle O'Neill.
Gotcha.
There you go.
Do you know what? All three of you are welcome to the
programme. Thank you very much. And you're very welcome to Cork. You lit up the whole atrium yesterday.
The atrium was great fun
absolutely.
Yesterday. The hub.
At the hub, it was absolutely fantastic, and we're just delighted to have you. And your passion for history was great, and I know that you'd mediate a lot with all the different students with all their own queries, but you were fantastic and it was lovely to have you.
Thank you. We just loved being there because we got a great insight into the minds and the thoughts of this generation.
Absolutely. And of course you also got a copy of the Atlas of the Irish Revolution,
what
which is from this parish.
Yeah.
Two of the editors, of course, are Dr. Donal O'Driscoll and John Borgavona. So we're very delighted to give you that copy. And I'm sure you'll have it all read the next time that I see you.
And learned off by rote, like
exactly.
The worst history classes of all time. But a beautiful presentation. And it won a lot of awards, I remember at the time.
Absolutely. Now, don't use it as a footstool.
No, it's a big old tome. It's definitely one that... So tell us about your role in UCC, if you would.
So I'm a broadcast historian. And essentially, UCC is the first undergraduate history degree that offers media history as part of its BA degree. So a few years ago, I would have to say now there were a couple of arched eyebrows when I started teaching about Gay Byrne, because I was talking to a cohort of 19, 20-year-olds.
Yep.
So their only resonance or affiliation with Gay Byrne would have been that he was chairperson of the Road Safety Authority.
Yep. Yep.
So when I began to talk about his radio programme, when I started talking about Anne Lovett, how he'd covered that story so forensically and so well, when I started talking about the Bishop Casey affair and on the Late Late Show, they just couldn't believe that all these incidents happened, you know, just prior to their lifetime, so to speak. So I began to look at Gay Byrne as a catalyst for change. And so gradually then I also introduced Irish film history as well. So we look at the film history through the prism of history. So I must say, we have a huge cohort of students now. And what really made me happy is that Gay Byrne is now part of the Leaving Cert history curriculum under the key personalities of the 20th century. So I really feel vindicated.
Well done, yeah.
And also I would have to say that RTE itself is part of the Leaving Cert history curriculum. There's a special question on RTE 1962 to 1972. So all of this broadcast history is now being seen as being integral to our overall history. So I'm really, really interested in that. But I'm also very interested, as you know, Ryan,
yes,
in performative history. So about 4 years ago, 2014, however, my maths are really bad, I set up the UCC Players, the staff drama group. And they're a wonderful bunch of people all together. I'm now the honorary president because I come and go, so to speak. And our first production was Walking with Ireland into the Sun. It's a play I wrote about the women of 1916. And I was trying to think, how would these women have met one another? So I began to think of the Citizen Army, which was the first European army where men and women were welcome. And I had Countess Markovitch and Margaret Skinner and people like Kathleen Lynn, Dr. Kathleen Lynn, who was the medical officer of the Irish Citizen Army, that they all met. And we staged the play, believe it or not. I love bespoke venues. So we staged the play up in the former women's jail up in Sunderswell.
Brilliant. What a great way to bring history alive.
It was just super. Yeah. And we had over 1,000 people at it.
Yeah, see, I think this is really interesting, Fionnuala, that Irish people, more than their so-called betters realise are much more interested in history and who we are than they get credit for. And I mean that in the sense that I think that the 1916 celebrate commemoration was kind of given a bit of a low-key run out initially. And suddenly the people reacted by saying, we want more of this and bigger. So it's definitely there.
Oh,
it just
absolutely
has to be done properly. This
absolutely
is what we keep saying.
Well, now, we are an amateur bunch. Now, they're going to get a heart attack when they hear this. But yes, so I'm on the 19th of March. I have adapted the inquest into the death of Tomás McCurtain. And Tomás McCurtain was the former Lord Mayor of Cork who was killed on his 36th birthday. Now, this is not a play.
I'm going to stop you there because a lot of people obviously know McCurtain Street. They know the story of Tomás McCurtain. But for the passing trade, let's remind ourselves. So he was the Lord Mayor of Cork, elected in January 1920.
That's right.
Just to put it shape. He hit 36. I think it was his birthday.
It was the night of his birthday, actually, that he was killed. Yeah.
Now, who killed him? This is important.
Well, you see, the point is, this is such a sensitive issue.
Because 100 years later.
Yes, but we've also had the RIC.
That's why I wanted to ask you.
Debacle and so forth. So we really have to be very, very sensitive. It's a very fragile area. So all I will say is that there's no triumphalism about this. So during my various research, it's obviously well known that a Lieutenant Colonel Swansea of the RIC possibly commanded that the hit on, we'll say, Tomás McCurtain. Mm. But he in return was coming out of mass at Lisburn in Northern Ireland and was killed. And then consequent to that, over 32 Catholics were killed. So it's a very tragic tale. And remember, the history casts such a long shadow.
Of course.
That we have to be so, so careful. So what I'm looking at really is, I'm looking at the event from a humane point of view. We're very fortunate. Yesterday I got confirmation that President Higgins and Zabina Higgins are going to come down.
Great.
To it.
Great.
So
great support
actors,
to the
if you're listening, you better start learning your lines.
Yeah.
But also, it's just so tremendous to have a president and Mrs. Higgins that are so interested in the cultural life.
Wasn't she involved in Sabina in a previous production?
I have been
college?
So fortunate. A year and a half ago, we celebrated 100 years of women's suffragism and the franchise. And Sabina Higgins led a cortege of 200 women dressed in period costume in the quad where you were yesterday as we celebrated 100 years of women's suffrage. It was a tremendous occasion.
The reason I wanted to light briefly on who shot Tomás McCurtain is because it echoes, we talk about the echoes of history, and that's 100 years ago, that's the RIC. The RIC, those three letters, arguably, and the black and tans, in some ways may have derailed 21st century Fine Gael's election campaign this year. Now, we're not going to get into it, but it certainly didn't help matters. I mean, it was extraordinary how loud the echo of history was in this election. Right, and to give it to all sides, you saw up the Ra, Sinn Féin TD in Waterford.
Yeah.
You saw that footage doing the rounds now. Bang! Excuse the expression, but we're suddenly back into history.
Well, I actually mentioned that in class yesterday.
Did you?
Because I know quite a lot of students voted Sinn Féin. They told me yesterday in class. And I'm just worried about the fact that we're not going back to that sort of Republican triumphalism. So I think we should be very, very fragile and very, very alert to the nuances of history.
Well, this is what I was saying about a younger person I spoke to yesterday who said, your history is, to talk about this generation, as parents, your history is Sinn Féin, IRA. My history is Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, wrecking the economy and not fixing it. Mm-hmm. Now, whose history is right?
Well, you see, this is it.
And I mean, when does history stop being politics? And when does politics become history?
Well, I often say that. I mean, when you look at even if me staging a play, it's from my perspective, it's like a director. I mean, we'll say, just to go back to a less contentious, when Neil Jordan made
Michael Collins,
right? There was a slew of anachronisms, even historically, if you're trying to be accurate. But at the same time, it was Neil Jordan's perspective. And many people were very, I suppose, upset over the dramatisation of De Valera, for example, who almost came across as being a feat. And
a panto.
Absolutely.
It was Alan Rickman played him.
Exactly. So we have to be very, very careful. And I suppose that's why I'm interested in all parts of history.
Yeah.
I was telling you, for example, tomorrow I'm going to give a talk in the Long Room in Trinity on the confessional radio, the history of how radio has almost displaced religion as a form of confessional, and that we don't ring our politicians anymore, we ring radio. And I'll be taking a look at the evolution of talk radio and confessional radio, right up from Dear Frankie to the Gay Byrne Show to Jerry Ryan Show, right up to Liveline, and just taking a look at what is it about us as a nation of talkers that we love to hear ourselves on the air.
Yeah. And I think that's Have you got an answer to that question?
I think we find ourselves very interesting.
Well, we find, no, we love a good yarn. Yes. We like a story. It could be sad or happy, but a story well told, particularly by somebody who's the first, the prima facie storyteller, you know, rather than wait till I tell you about someone else. We seem to be intrigued by that, especially if it's authentic.
Inúla Fualán often said that. I mean, when she spoke with Marion Finucane, and you mentioned that earlier on your show about the passing of such veteran broadcasters.
Yes.
So I often wonder, I mean, what I used to often see about Gay Byrne, for example, was that he was naturally an entertainer. He came from the variety.
Almost vaudeville. Circuit,
yeah. So whereas an awful lot of the current presenters really are kind of journalistic.
Yeah.
So where would you see yourself as emanating from, Ryan? So
I've caught in the middle with you. stuck in the middle with you. I don't know what I am, to be honest with you, in terms of broadcasting. But I'm interested in everything. So
I think you need to be a bit zany as well. You had the Zoo Radio type then of Gerry Ryan.
Yeah.
So I just think it's very interesting. So I suppose overall history really embraces everybody.
Mm.
And the performative side of it, I also have a master's in drama and theatre studies, so that kind of helps as well.
But you have to be a bit of a performer to
do
this job.
You know, and I was never a good actress, so I may as well be a good director.
Yeah, anyway, it'd be great on the radio too. But I do think that in terms of confessional, if you want to call it that, or storytelling, the one thing I get from guests in terms of guests with a story to tell is that they just want to communicate to the person on the couch at home or in the car at home and say to them, you're not on your own. And I think that there's a comfort in that. It's not actually them, you know, getting a trip out of coming on and telling their story. It's actually on the contrary. It's them saying, I've done this and I want to tell you that if you're doing this, if you're going on the same road as I am, don't feel so lonely. And there's a kindness and an altruism to that that I
totally
admire.
Agree. And I just thought that yesterday as well, you know, you had a lovely engaging manner about you yesterday. And I think that you've won a whole host of hearts yesterday. And I think, so if you're passing by the Long Room in Trinity tomorrow, drop in if you can.
It sounds interesting to say the least.
And even on the 19th of March, you can join President Higgins and Sabina and the Lord Mayor and our own President. There'll be a whole host of people there if you wanted to come down.
Well, I love what you're doing for history and that idea of, so it's going to be the trial of the inquest.
So
sorry,
the inquest into the death of Tomás McCarthy.
Done in the style of a
courtroom,
really?
It was actually originally in the City Hall. So we have the voices of Cork Choir under the baton of Eamon Nash. They're a local Cork Choir going to sing as well. I've chosen some beautiful music. I love to layer it up as well. I love the whole production side of it. And in conjunction with Brenda Lynch, a colleague of mine, we both adapted it for stage, so to speak. It was originally 96 witnesses. We've whittled it down to 13. So it's going to be rather difficult. You have to add a bit of drama and you have to take a bit of dramatic license because it would otherwise be very
boring. I was going to ask you about that. You mentioned Michael Collins, the kind of off-colour joke at the time. Who shot Michael Collins? Of course, the answer, Neil Jordan. He made the film. And it was a desperate joke, but that's what it was. But tell me this. When you get to a film like In the Name of the Father, Jim Sheridan's film, which I remember showing to she's now my oldest daughter, and it really triggered, again, excuse the expression, but it did trigger an interest in history for her. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she did the Leaving Cert special topic on that subject. Yeah, because...
Love to talk to her.
But I was saying to her at the time, this is not a document.
Yes.
This is an engaging, engrossing film that would make your blood boil, which it does. So how do you tell students not to watch? It's like, don't watch Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet and think you're watching Shakespeare. Mm. You know, you have to be careful.
I actually teach that in class in The Name of the Father, and I often talk about the artistic license that Jim Sheridan has taken, because the father and son did not share a cell, but it was part of that narrative, you know, the name, In the Name of the Father, and of course the next line is of the son. So that was the metaphor throughout the whole film. But I think Jim Sheridan's work has been tremendous because he has taken a look at, I suppose, British injustice and has used film as a medium of narrating on that.
Yeah.
But what was also very important was the fact is that Ireland have an incredible narrative, and he was also looking at colonialism. You know, there's that beautiful scene where they throw down the lanterns to commemorate the death of Giuseppe. So, and I also say that, you know, I've been involved at the moment as well in T.G. Carr. I was telling you yesterday that T.G. Carr are great for adapting history.
Tremendous superb stuff. Yeah, they did the Mam Trasna murders very well, actually, which would chime with what you're saying.
Absolutely. So I've just finished filming a series called In Raw and Hair, in Ireland's Greatest Love Stories. And I've taken a look at, I might be actually on the cutting floor for all.
I doubt that.
They liked my jackets, that's all I can say. But that's going to be out in autumn. And they took a look at famous love stories like Michael Collins, Kitty Kiernan. They took a look even at Oscar Wilde and Bose, his boyfriend.
Yes.
And they also took a look at Grainne O'Malley.
When is that on?
It's going to be in the autumn. It's going to be fantastic. Great. By Bow Media. And actually, Maureen Connell, who's the commissioning editor in TG Carr, she's coming down to our event on March 19th as well, so it should be really interesting. So I just think there's a great excitement. I love going into the lecture theatre lecturing. I would have to say my dream job would be something like Lucy Worsley. You know Lucy Worsley?
I do, of course,
I'd love
to
be her. I'd love to be presenting. I think there's not enough history. I don't agree, I'm probably going to get criticism for this, but I don't agree in separating women's history from history. I think it should all be part of the one. I don't like the idea of
the herstory.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now they've done tremendous stuff, but I think you would never say male history.
They'll argue, we'll have to argue this for a moment, they will argue that we've had male history for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and that is time, and maybe eventually we'll be able to conflate the two. And
think about someone like Countess Markovic, was the first lieutenant of the Irish Citizen Army, you know.
Yeah.
Kathleen Nim was the first medical officer of the Irish Citizen Army, so they should all be incorporated as part of the narrative.
We could be here all day. And with great happiness, I can assure you, but I have to bring another guest in to say hello to us in a minute. Fionnuala, it's been a real pleasure to meet you yesterday and today. Thanks for the lovely welcome at UCC.
You're more than welcome. You lit up our atrium, our hub, as
we
I
had
say.
A ball. No, honestly, God, we really had a ball, and thank you for your time. Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill.
That's it.
That right, long room in history in Trinity tomorrow.
Four p.m.
You are an evangelist for history, and we love you for it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for
your
time.
And so are you. Thank you.
Okay, it's 9:43 this Tuesday morning. We're live from Cork. We'll have plenty more for you coming up after this. Shannon Joyce, how nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having me this morning.
How are you?
Good, great, thank you.
We spoke on the Late Late Show.
We did.
You had Roisin with you at that stage. Is she still three?
I left her at home. She stole my limelight the last time everybody was talking about her.
Just leave her.
Yeah,
at home.
I just left her.
She shouldn't be
shouldn't be interfering.
Cutting
really,
in on
she?
Your. How's she doing? She's still three.
She's still three. Well, she's kind of three, going on 23.
Yeah.
She's absolutely the most dramatic little 3-year-old you'd ever meet in your life.
But She's good.
She's good. She's good. Keeping me on my toes.
You're 25 years old.
I am.
You're from Youghal.
Yep.
And because we were in Cork today, we wanted to catch up and see how you're doing. Just if we could just go back just a few steps to remind people why you're here in some ways, because you were 19 years old, weren't you?
Yeah.
And I think just briefly, you found a lump.
Yeah, so I had found a lump in my groin.
That's
In kind of the summer of 2014. And through the jigs and reels of it, it turned out that it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So I was diagnosed with stage 3 lymphoma at 19. Took very well to my chemotherapy, went through the treatment and everything, and came out the other side, thankfully. Went on, met my partner Barry, went on to live a very normal life, had Roisin, and then 5 years almost to the date, I found the same lump in the exact same place.
Didn't the original doctor suggest it was an ingrown hair?
Yeah, so an ingrown hair. And then when that kind of wasn't going away, they were saying, oh, maybe you've given yourself an infection, so you've kind of got swollen glands or swollen nodes.
Well, what were you doing? Were you vomiting or sweating?
Yeah, so back then I suppose I was very symptomatic. So I was fatigued, I was losing weight, I was kind of getting like night sweats, but probably not really taking much notice of them. So I had a lot of symptoms, but like probably I was vomiting a lot, like every day I couldn't eat, you know, so that's why we were saying she's obviously losing weight because of that. But it turns out that that's literally the symptoms of the lymphoma.
So you came through that. And 5 years to the day, you got news to say it's not good.
Yeah, so July again, 2019, I had just started a new role in my job, in my current job. So I'd started a new role and...
As what? Tell us what you were doing.
So it was a corporate relationship manager. I'd just gotten the job. I'd worked in Laya Healthcare in sales for 2 years. So I was fighting my way to get into corporates and I finally got in and I started on the Monday. I worked Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, went to Dublin for my first meeting. I thought, this is great. This is going so
well.
You're on the road. I'm on the road. I'm on the up. And then on the Wednesday night when I got home from Dublin, I wasn't feeling well, found the lump, and I was biopsied that Friday. I actually met my professor Seamus O'Reilly on the Thursday evening. He organised a biopsy within 12 hours and I got biopsied, and unfortunately those results came back probably a week, a little bit over a week later, and they said they rang and they said, look, do you want to come up for your results? We have them. And you know when they say that, that it's not great news. If it was okay, they'd say, look, you're fine, you're in the clear, you're fine. And he said, they said to me, do you want to pop up to us there up in the Mercy? We have your results. And I said, no, it's fine, you can tell me over the phone. I kind of had a gut feeling, I kind of knew. And Professor Riley wasn't entirely pleased with the lump. He said it was a kind of a very full lump, you know, if it was just an infected lymph node again or something like that, it would be grainy. That's how he described it. But he said it was quite a full lump, so we had to biopsy it, and unfortunately it came back again. So I had my scans and it was stage 3 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Which is where you are now.
Yeah.
How did you process that? 5 years on, you were just about to start. You know, Roisin was thriving. You feel, knocked that out of the park. Yeah. Time to get going with my life. And then you get hit over the head with this
club and it kind of definitely knocks you back. I felt like I literally took a step forward and really got knocked back 10, you know.
When I was in Crumlin and I was talking to parents of kids, I remember meeting one couple and I said, how are you guys like smiling and talking to each other and still going? And in fairness to them, they said, we are now, but you might see us in an hour. And we'll have our heads in our hands.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you the same? Because you seem such a... I've only met you a couple of times, but you seem to have such a happy happy demeanour that I can't... I just can't see you really upset, if you know what I'm saying. But you must be.
Yeah, of course. Like, and you know, a lot of it is positive mental attitude. I really think that if you have a positive attitude, that's half the
battle. Do you believe
I really and truly do. Okay. Like, and I've kind of proven it to myself the last couple of weeks. So the last time I was up with you, I was saying that I was due to go in for a transplant in St. James's. So I went and I had all that, and I got home, and there was kind of days where I literally felt like I couldn't get out of my pyjamas, and for about 4 days I stayed in my pyjamas, and I was really, really low on myself. And as you know, I'm doing the whole Instagram thing, and I didn't take to Instagram. My phone was away, and I kind of shut myself off from the outside world. And it was only 4 days, but I felt very, very low. And Barry said to me, maybe try get up and just get dressed and have a shower today. And, you know, and then the more I kind of started doing normal things and putting a smile on my face and, you know, having people call to the house, I actually felt better. So
did you want people to call and normalise things?
Yeah, I had to kind of start trying to get back into routine and getting back into normality, because, you know, it was just a bit of a hectic Christmas. People wanted to call. I didn't want to see anybody. Yeah. And it was just a tough couple of weeks. But, you know, then I said, like, and in my head, I was genuinely gone quite low. And I said, no, you have to just take yourself out of this rut now. You know, it's time to get up, put on your big girl pants and move on with it.
Move on.
And I did, and I feel much, you know, I'm in a much happier place now already. So definitely your mental health and a positive mindset is half the battle.
Where is the cancer now, Shannon?
The cancer is good. It's no cancer cells at the moment, thank God. I have a scan the end of this month, and hopefully that scan, it's called your 100 days after transplant scan, so I have that, and hopefully that will say the same thing. And if it does, then we just keep going the way we're going, scan kind of every 3 months and make sure that it's kept at bay. But at the moment there's no active cancer cells.
So is it looking good then?
Yeah, it's looking good. You're not getting rid of me.
No, I don't want to. No, you're one of those people I love to see coming through the door because you're kind. And the last time you were on the show, you had no hair.
Yes.
Today you have and you were in the paper the other day for Daffodil Day, and you had no hair.
With no hair.
Today you have flowing, long, blonde locks.
I just like to confuse people. Yeah, it was
I tell
funny.
You what, it's good.
Yeah, no, it is. It's actually a very good hairpiece.
Where
yeah,
did you get that
brilliant.
One?
It's a lady called Michelle from Amari Wigs. She's based in Middleton, but Michelle has actually been like
it's really
a
good
of support. She's been amazing. Yeah, Amari Wigs in Middleton. That's where she's based, but she does house calls as well. So she's kind of all around the Cork.
Fair play, because it's like you obviously happy wearing. That
oh, absolutely.
Hairpiece,
yeah. And you know, it's funny. I was up. We had the launch. I'm an ambassador for the Irish Cancer Society, and we had the launch of Daffodil Day last Friday.
Yeah.
So when I walked into the room, there were these big posters. We made the front of the Independent, myself and Roisin. It was just mental. There was pictures everywhere, but I had no hair in any of them. So then at the end of the Daffodil Day, I was going up to give a speech, and I walked up with a full head of hair, and I was saying, people are going to be like, who's this girl? Because she's not the girl that's in the paper.
And here she is.
Yeah.
Did you hope to, I mean, with Instagram, do you find that it's a sort of comfort or an outlet, or how are you feeling about it?
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like it's been an amazing platform of support for me.
Great.
And I feel, because you do feel a little bit useless in all this, you know, you're kind of wondering, what am I going to do? And I want, like, this is the second time it's happened. I wanted to raise awareness. I wanted to let people know that you have to go and get your smear test. You have to go and get your prostate screenings. You have to go and get yourself checked, because if you don't help yourself, then you can't be helped. So if you're skipping your screenings and you're skipping these routine things, like, and it does come knocking on your door, it could have been prevented. And with cancer, early detection is the most important thing. It's vital. It really is. It can save your life. So I kind of said, right, let's try and make a difference. Let's try and make people aware that cancer doesn't discriminate. I'm 25. By the time I was 24, I had 2 stage 3 cancer diagnoses. I've gone through chemotherapy twice. I've had transplants. You know, it does happen. And I'm not like a smoker. I don't drink a lot. I'm quite healthy, you know. I would say active, but I haven't been very active the last couple of months.
Yeah,
but
you're entitled to be.
I do take care of myself. I work. I'm just normal, and it's happened to me twice. So I just said, let's take social media and give a real insight to cancer and what it does to a young family.
The Cancer Society are really lucky to have you.
And I'm lucky to have them. We are very lucky as a country to have them.
So Daffodil Day, Friday, 27th of March. Cancer.ie if you want to get involved in that. You're on Instagram as big_c_and_me. It's a lot of underscoring.
Just to complicate it.
Well, let's do a picture together after this for that, and I'll put on mine too so that we can share the good news. Shannon, it's so good to see you. You've got your folks in with you, so let's say hello to them after the show, and good luck to you and to Roisin and the gang at home.
Thank you very much.
Don't be a stranger now.
I won't.
Good to see you. Shannon Joyce joining us live here. And thank you so much in the Cork studios. It's 3 minutes to 10 o'clock. Well, I watched an intriguing documentary film called Jihad Jane yesterday, and the writer and director of the film, Kieran Cassidy, joins us this morning. Good morning, Kieran. Nice to see you again.
Thanks very much for having me.
Who was Jihad Jane? Simple start, and we'll get stuck into it then.
Jihad Jane was a woman called Colleen Rose, and maybe why Irish people are wondering about a woman called Jihad Jane was that she was arrested in Waterford, or it was surrounding activities in Waterford in 2009. So Colleen Rose was a 47-year-old woman at the time, an American, blonde hair, coming from Texas, who had been previously living in Pennsylvania. And she had basically gone online, started creating this alter ego called Jihad Jane, and she started communicating with people in Baltimore, in Colorado, and mainly Waterford, a guy who was there calling himself Black Flag. And this kind of plot culminated or surrounded the idea of killing a Swedish cartoonist. But they were arrested in Waterford, and the name Jihad Jane kind of created global headlines. It was the lead story on NBC, it was the lead story on CNN, and Colleen and the story then became quite a major talking point.
I mean, you've mentioned Sweden, Waterford and Texas. Mm-hmm. This is the sort of shrinking globe, courtesy of the internet.
100%.
And the beautiful alliterative baddie of a name of Jihad Jane, adding to the colour of the story.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to say nobody gets killed in the making of this story. I think that could, because otherwise we may sound flippant.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think like the thing you pointed out there straight away was, like, when I started down, we started looking at the story about 2011, 2012. And the first thing that struck me when I started looking at this case, so to the audience to get an idea, the cast of characters involved is so disparate. So you've got a very introverted mother of one in Colorado. You got a teenager with Asperger's in Baltimore. Then you've got a guy who's unemployed down in Waterford. And then you've got Colleen, who is the kind of the lead kind of figure in this. Yeah. This blonde woman who's basically moved from, who had this brutal background, which we can go into later,
yes,
but was living in Pennsylvania and was just spending 8-9 hours on the internet the whole time. And this story wouldn't have happened in the 70s or the 60s.
Without the internet.
It was all the internet.
And all roads will lead us back there. But for the purpose of the film that you've made, and also the story broadly speaking, let's join the dots. And I'm going to ask you something, which is, if when you're telling a story, just keep with the code names.
Okay, yeah.
Rather, because it might be a little confusing. So we'll just go with who's who, and we'll concentrate on the geography. So connect those dots, geographical and otherwise, together first, Kieran, and then we'll talk about the implications and the psychodrama beneath it afterwards.
Yeah, well, I think that one of the people that was communicating it was clearly Jihad Jane, and this was somebody who was posting comments and videos frequently on YouTube and a number of other channels, but she was calling for Jihad and she was communicating with other people and organising. The other person was kind of ringleader, would have been a person called Black Flag. That really is the Irish connection. Black Flag would have been based out of Waterford, and this person was kind of very upfront about their experience, that they previously had been involved in Jihad, but also said that they had a training camp and they had brothers and come over here to Waterford. Come here, you know, you'll get married, we'll have, you know, we'll be able to kind of take it on to the next.
And train you for train jihad.
Train you, jihad and all of this. Yeah. So, like, he kind of presented himself online as this kind of experienced internet kind of jihadi. And then you had Eagle Eye, who, even to this day, is very mysterious and is nobody really knows who this person is. But the hunch from some people is that it's either a troll who infiltrated the group and was kind of egging them on, or it could have been an FBI agent or somebody like that.
Because, a honey trap of sorts.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. The easiest way to keep an eye on this group is just to post. And then when you're wondering whether they're going to do something, just suggest, why don't you, you know, and see how it goes. But nobody really knew about Eagle Eye. So that was another person in the mix now. And then finally, because I know people are just getting going through this kind of vast cast character, in Baltimore, there was a teenager called Mohammed Hassan Khaled. He really didn't have a nickname, but he had Asperger's and he was just online all the time. He had moved over from Pakistan and he'd kind of fallen into this very weird internet group that were kind of communicating with each other all the time. And then finally, we have in Colorado, there was a woman who had logged on and she wasn't proactive, but she started communicating and she kind of attracted attention because she was another American woman who was communicating with the group as well.
Let's focus on Black Flag, living in Waterford, working in Waterford, eventually entices the two American women over to Waterford.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So Jihad Jane finds a way here and the other lady you mentioned finds a way here.
Yeah.
He marries the other lady.
Jamie, yeah, yeah.
And has a baby with her.
Yeah.
And Jihad Jane, meanwhile, when she lands here, what happens?
Yeah, well, like, she arrives. She had made like a very sudden emergency decision to come to Ireland. And she'd come to kind of be reunited with Black Flag. And when she arrived, she told us, she arrived into the apartment and Jamie was there, the other American woman.
Yes.
And she talked online with the American woman, but she didn't realise she was coming over as well. So all of a sudden, there's two American women in this guy who's calling himself Black Flag's apartment in Waterford.
And how old is Black Flag, or what's his background, or what did he?
Ali Sharaf Dimash was Algerian who'd spent a long time living in France. I think he'd a number of children in France and then moved to Ireland. And I think he'd worked in Cork. Point that when he, all during those stages, he wasn't radicalized. Okay. This wasn't. He didn't arrive over here and this, like, he was going about his normal life and this was low beneath the surface. He was married to an Irish woman and she says it just started happening over time and then she broke up with him and then he kind of started living in Waterford and then he started going online and then he started communicating with these women.
Okay, so he gets them over to the flat and now they suddenly have a sort of like a weird Mexican standoff with two Americans and this other head looking at each other going, what's next?
Well, I think the thing about it is that, to put it in terms to the audience, they had a lot of plans online. They talked a lot. They had seen each other as avatars, but they'd never met each other.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, reality came crashing in when they were all sitting in this one-bedroom apartment in the centre of Waterford. And I think like one of the first things Dimash was looking for was like the ATM card of Jamie because he didn't have any money. So like the reality of the camp, the reality of what he was kind of proposing. And it was mad that they were coming over and this is maybe what they were expecting.
Yes.
But then the reality kind of hit them as well. Now, the point about it is that tension then existed between the two women in the apartment as it played out over the next month and so. The relationship then would have deteriorated. Like, I think Jamie didn't really like Colleen. I think Colleen's felt that Ali Sharaf Dimash prioritised marriage over the idea that they were going to go ahead with their plans.
So sticking with the guy in Waterford who'd promised training camp and there was talk that they would be assassinating the cartoonist in Sweden who put the prophet's head on a body of an animal.
On a dog.
On a dog's head. And they said, we want you to go and kill him. So where was the training camp in the day shit? Like what came of all of this?
Yeah, like I think like The thing about it was, I think from Colleen's perspective, she saw none of it. She experienced, like, it never really got off the ground. Lars Vilks didn't come up and mention anymore. And
the cartoonist.
Yeah. And she started like kind of losing interest. I think with Dimash, there's a danger of, like, I think his plan was kind of absurd and it was kind of farcical and he went around the wrong way. there was a darkness going on there concerning how he dealt. Jamie Paul and Ramirez had arrived over with her child, and when you're talking about training, he was taking the child off, and he wasn't bringing Jamie with him, and there was just a strangeness in how he interacted with the two women, especially Jamie.
Was he a spoofer?
I think the thing about it is that, like, you can never say what was fully going on. Like, okay. Let's say law enforcement were listening, they said he'd just have to get it right once. But the thing about it was, what he did do and his plan was, like, bringing Colleen over. Colleen was putting everyone on the internet. Colleen was being tracked.
Jane.
You know, she would attract attention wherever she went. She was very loud. She contacted the FBI from Waterford. One of the things that she told us before, we're kind of talking, it isn't in the film, but when she was deciding, okay, this is not working out. This guy is not what he promised to be, and I want to go home. She went up to the Garda station in Waterford, and she looked for the FBI department. And then there was no FBI department. So the guy got confused, asked, what she was looking for, and then she just headed off. So it was just very surreal and very bizarre and very strange about what was going on in the apartment down at Waterford over that period of time.
Okay. And she decided ultimately that this thing is a complete mess, I'm off.
Yeah.
And she said, I'm going to be caught, essentially. So she calls the FBI and puts her hands up and says, get me home, I'll tell you everything, and I can go. I presume she thought she could walk free then if she told them everything. She hadn't done anything per se.
Exactly. Like, that's the thing with Colleen. I think she saw this as kind of an adventure. This is fun. This is exciting. And her lawyer always contends that she just thought she would just tell the truth about what had happened, and then she would be kind of shown out the door.
How long did she spend in prison?
She spent 8 years in prison. So we were there, I think, the very day she was getting out of prison. We were waiting at the gates for her. And the prison authorities saw us out of the gates. So they threw her into a van. And they dropped her on a border in Georgia.
Where you met her?
Yeah, we met her on the side of the road. And then we brought her back to her probation officer in Pennsylvania.
Lord. Okay. Well, look, let's look at the bigger picture in some ways, which is, you've described a raggle-taggle bunch of misfits who spend too much time on the internet.
Yeah.
Did you find the story was really about that sense of loneliness online?
Yeah. Like, I think the thing about it is that, like, I think part of the story is when you look at it, you're kind of saying raggle-taggle. Like, I think Colleen had this incredibly bleak, incredibly tough background, and a very, very damaged person who had found herself through sexual abuse, from her father when she was 8 years of age. Then she was a child prostitute from 13. I think one of her first customers when she was a child prostitute, she married. And then she just went into, like, heavy drink and drugs during that period of time. And I think, the other people involved had kind of very similar tough backgrounds. And they all drifted, it's a very online story. And I think one of the things that really struck me about the story going through it was nobody here went near a mosque. Nobody, there was no radical preacher. Yeah. This was all on YouTube. And what it was is just at this period of time, now they've cleaned up concerning, say, jihadi videos, but you can still get a lot of white nationalist videos online. But they were very readily available, and then people could go in and just communicate with each other on the message board. So you could put a comment up on it, and then somebody would go in and reply to yours. So there was very damaged, very lost, very lonely people communicating with each other from different parts of the world.
And like so many people on the internet, they think that they have they get puffed up in their sense of importance, even though they're kind of it's a sad life they're leading, really, and they're fantasists.
Yeah, well, I think with Colleen, when I was chatting with her in prison, we'd ring her and we'd chat with her and we'd record those conversations, and that's in the film. And I remember asking her, she told me, I told her, why did you do it? What got you so excited about it? Why were you so enthused? And she said, I felt so important.
There you go.
Yeah, and then I said, when else in your life have you felt important? And she paused, and she paused, and she just couldn't think of any other time that she had felt important.
Yeah.
So she was on this online community, and people were cheering her on, people were applauding her. And I do then think the other thing about it was, which was interesting from my perspective, was that the media then kind of played a role in it. Because if she'd gone to the FBI offices and she had walked out the back door with a kind of a warning, this is kind of crazy behavior, you have to watch this, it probably would have been seen as a failure in her eyes. But what happened was, this became the biggest story in America.
Yeah.
She became like she was a celebrity in her prison. prison warders were banging on the thing.
Did she get a kick out of that?
Oh, she loved it. Like that was the thing. Like when she had gone through such a, like, I was chatting to her, a defense attorney, when she was in prison, and he said, like, she has had such a tough life. The prison is fine for her. There's absolutely, she's not feeling seen this as a negative. And because she got, like, and it's kind of like looking at terrorism is a media operation. Like, people do things, terrible things, to get attention and to get, like, coverage. And in a strange kind of way, in this story, she was delighted that she got all this attention.
You know, I was watching a documentary about Raqqa a few years ago and the ISIS or Daesh or whatever they want to call themselves. Where you got this sense that the people who were, a lot of the people of the jihadis and the recruits were kind of like that. They got online, spent a lot of time online, dispossessed economically, intellectually maybe, and headed off on this anti-adventure. And I got the sense from, I got the sense certainly from your film, that the that all the players, Black Flag in his flat in Waterford, fantasist for all intents and purposes, Jihad Jane, lonely, damaged, troubled, the other one from Colorado with her own troubles, all joining together in this sort of triumvirate of pity and attention seeking.
And I think the thing about it is that I felt is that one of the important things you got to remember is, like, back in 2004, 2005. Broadband speeds began to increase. So, like, it may seem a bit novel now to somebody listening, but, like, I remember watching the first time on YouTube a goal being scored and thinking, this is incredible. Where are we now at this edge of technology where I can watch a goal again, you know? And I think one of the first groups to really realise the potential of this was actually jihadis and, like, you know, extremists in general, like white nationalists and whatnot. And I think around that time, we got some of the videos and we could see the videos that jihadis were sending over that that actually Colleen watched, that she radicalised her, and that would have, Mohammed Hassan Khalid would have been watching. And you can see the production values increasing. So, like, from when they started off, they're very kind of rinky-dink, poor production. But by the end, some of the stuff that was coming out of the caliphate was very, very high-end. And this was the stuff that they were sending back and that they were selling to younger marginalised or disenfranchised people who were then going over there. And then there was a different reality when they arrived there. But at the very centre of that was platforms that were actually allowing the videos to be up there and these videos to be widely circulated and get huge viewership.
Where's Jihadi Jane now? Are you in touch with her still?
She is now trying to just go lead a normal life. She is in a very kind of safe place, living just a very normal rural life. I don't think anybody where she lives and who know who she is and her background.
Okay, it's a fascinating film. It's called Jihad Jane. And Kieran, well done on it, and to you and the production behind it. Really super stuff. And there's a special screening at the IFI tomorrow at 6:15. Is that
tomorrow
right?
Tomorrow at
6:15. Q&A with yourself?
Yeah, Q&A.
And wonderful.
And then I think it's in the IFI Lighthouse and
Omniplex Rathmines, Waterford. Should be in Waterford.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of people there will want to get a great kick out of it. And Triskell Arts Centre in Cork and the Palace, as they call it, in Galway. Congratulations on your latest production, Onwards and Upwards.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming to see us this morning, Kieran Cassidy.
Thanks.
All right, at 18 minutes to 10, more after this. It's 9:25 and I'm more than happy to welcome Mr. Gordon Goodwin to the studio this morning. Welcome, Gordon. Nice to see you.
Thanks, Ryan. Glad to be here.
I think your story will resonate with so many people today because it's about something. We're pretty much the same age. And I'd like you to go back to childhood for a second. To when you were maybe at school or what have you, and you realised, I'm just not getting this when you're reading or whatever. What was happening?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've always struggled with reading. I mean, I'm 40, I still struggle with reading. And in school, you know, it was, I suppose you start off in junior infants and everything's wonderful and everything's great. And then you start learning to read through various different books. You progress to senior infants and so on. So I think the first... time I realised that a real problem was, I always tried to avoid it. I always tried to avoid reading.
Sure.
And there was one particular time when I was talking to somebody the other day, I remembered I was, I think it was in senior infants, and I was asked to go out to get a projector or something like that to bring down to the school. And this was great. I mean, when you got to go out into the school and go out and
escape.
Exactly. Yeah. So I went up to third class and to get this projector, and I walked in, and at that moment, another boy was obviously struggling to read, and the teacher was giving him a bit of a hard time, And I remember saying, listen, this little junior infant's boy, or first class boy, will show you how it's done. And boy, did she pick the wrong kid, you know. So she made me read in front of the class, stand up in front of the class and read. And obviously I went into tears, and it's certainly a lasting memory.
Yeah.
But shortly after that, I would have been diagnosed with dyslexia. Now, it was never made clear to me. You know, it's only in recent years did I kind of understand what the classes. I used to go out of school every Wednesday. I have a clear memory of this.
Yeah.
When I was in kind of first class or second class, and I'd go to I could tell you where the house is.
Yes.
You know, but I don't remember the lady's name. And I'd go for about an hour, and we'd read stories and books with different colour pages on it, and so on.
Yes.
And so forth. Now, nobody had ever said to me that I was dyslexic at this point in time, and. But so I did that for about a year or two, and you know, I suppose then that all ended. And whether it had a great effect on me at the time, I'm not quite sure. Yeah. I suppose.
Can I ask you what dyslexia is in terms of what you were seeing when we'd all be reading words? What do you see, or what's happening on the page?
Well, it's funny for me. I mean, you know, I always say this. I even recently read a news headline, and I said to my wife, "Look at this. This is crazy." And I read it out to her as I saw it, and she said, "Gordon, that's not what that says at all." And then I realised, oh my God, it's the words work themselves properly for me.
Yeah.
It's funny when I'm reading with my little boy Ben. You know, since he started going to school and he started learning to read and so on and so forth, we'd try to read little books at night, and I'd be there to watch through how he's reading. And I remember one time about a year ago, we were reading. Me and Ben was reading, and I was there to kind of chaperone him reading. And my little 5-year-old daughter was sitting on top of my shoulder, and he read this line. And then my little 5-year-old said, "Daddy, that's not what that says." And she was right. It was right. Ben had got it wrong. I'd got it wrong in the exact same way as he had.
How does that feel?
Yeah, well, it's funny. It only has started to feel in the last couple of years, because what I've done my whole life is kind of circumvented it. I mean, I've tried to surround myself with people who can do that for me and do certain things for me and write and read particular sections of things.
So let's go back to school again just for a second, because you broached it in a way with the teacher you mentioned on Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah.
How did you hide then for secondary school and things like that? Because it's a lot based on reading.
Yeah, of course it is.
That takes some scheming to get around it.
It does. Yeah. Well, I often think kind of that's where I honed my negotiation skills that have
I bet.
Served me quite well in life. Yeah.
Okay.
But I did a lot of hiding. Actually, literally, I'll tell you about that in a little while.
Tell me, where did you hide, or what would you do?
Well, actually, in the toilets at one point, but I'll come back to that in a minute.
But
moving through school,
yes.
I mean, you know, junior school, I had an up and down approach to school. I mean, I had one really, really wonderful teacher who really worked very, very hard with me. And again, you know, there's a lot of children in school. There's 30 children, and there's different people with different level skill sets. So it's difficult for to be captured all the time.
Sure.
And indeed, as you get into senior school, that gets even more difficult. But I remember fifth class in school was a really strong year for me. I was feeling really good.
Yes.
After having a difficult start. Now, I must say I enjoyed school. I enjoyed my friends.
You weren't in the horror.
I wasn't the type of guy who dreaded going in. I mean, I pulled a fair few sickies in my time, like everybody else did, but I wasn't worried about going into school any day.
Yes.
And so the fifth class was really quite good, and I thought I excelled to a certain extent. And then I went to sixth class and fell back again. And then obviously moving into senior school. A part here is just, it's kind of important, I suppose, to go back to my little boy's story, is I always remember I went to school in a school, so I went from 5 all the way up to senior school.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have to suffer the worry of moving in with new people or new kids when I went into senior school.
Sure.
Ironically, that year, my parents decided to take us to away on holidays to California late in the summer, and we didn't return until 2 weeks into the school year. And so I came home, and I thought this was great in Disneyland while everybody else was doing their homework. And I came home, arrived in school 2 weeks late, and all my friends were gone separate ways. It was a very, very difficult time, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I suppose you're in that atmosphere where you can hide, and you can, you know, hide away from teachers. You're moving through different classes and so on.
Did you kind of make yourself less visible?
I did.
The toilet, what happened?
Yeah, I did. Well, the toilet was, that was...
Your second home by the sounds of it.
It was. Well, that was business studies. and it was just ironic again, but
yeah.
That was business studies in second class. And, second year. And I remember going into the class on one of the very early stages, and the teacher was fond of people reading.
Okay.
And he asked people to do a paragraph. I could feel it as it was coming to my turn, and I really struggled with this paragraph. And he told me to go home and write out the paragraph 100 times, which was, you know,
Victorian.
Ridiculous. Yeah. Needless to say, I didn't do that. So what I decided to do the following day was hide in the toilet for the class, and I did that for about 4 or 5 months before I was caught.
That's a long time for a student to be missing from a class.
It is, yeah. And nobody really noticed, you know. So that's what I did to kind of hide away. I suppose I always tried to... Yeah, you're right. I tried to be invisible in school. At a point, you get caught out and teachers start taking a little bit more interest, or maybe they were... taking interest in me, but you know, you can get away with homework and
how did you get away with Leaving Cert?
Well, the Leaving Cert, I knew that was going to be a nightmare.
Yeah.
So I decided to get a job and be employed for the time when the Leaving Cert results arrived. So I was doing my Leaving Cert, and it was on a Saturday night after kind of the first couple of exams, English Paper 1, English Paper 2, and I'd met somebody that I know from a car dealership down not too far from where I live, and I asked her, were there any jobs going there? And she said, yeah, somebody just left. I thought this was a great piece of luck. So I went down to the dealership on the Saturday. I got all dressed up instead of studying like I should have been, but studying again wasn't my thing. I waited pretty much all day for the sales manager to speak with me for a brief period of time, and he said, yeah, listen, nice to meet you, you need to come back and interview with the boss next kind of Thursday. And that was right smack bang in the middle of my technical drawing exam. So I had to sneak out of technical drawing very, very early in order to go and get this job. And thankfully I got the job. And the plan was that I'd get this job, and my parents would be so proud of me, they wouldn't want to know about the Leaving Cert results.
Another decoy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so lo and behold, I took the job, and I was working. I mean, I was working from 7 in the morning to 7 at night, and I was working Saturdays and everything. You work quite hard in that game. But and the Leaving Cert results arrived. I went down to pick them up, and I pulled up outside the school, and I opened the dreaded envelope, and it was atrocious. So I sealed the envelope and I rang my parents and I told them, and they said, listen, look, that's okay. The plan had worked. They said, that's okay. You're working now. You're doing great. You're doing your thing. Don't worry about it all. Yeah. So I put away the Leaving Cert results, and that was it. The plan obviously was originally to get the results, get away with it, and then in a month's time leave the job. But that never happened. I continued in work.
And on you went. What did you do for your wedding speech?
Well, this is the thing. I can't read out something. So in any sort of speech I'd have to make, I'll always have to memorise it. I'll have it in front of me like it's like I'm reading off it, but I'll have to memorise it.
But you're sure not reading anything?
No, I'm not. No, it's just a tool, really, a prompt, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll have to remember it. If I'm in work, if I ever make any speeches or anything like that, I'll always have to read it out, take me a long time to read. I mean, I can read, and I'm progressing much better in the last number of years with, I suppose, smartphones and things like this. I'm trying to read better and
have you ever read a book?
No. Well, I have, yes.
Which one?
I read my first book.
What was it?
About 2 weeks ago.
Really? Your first ever book?
My first ever book. Well, other than Anne and Barry Now in School, which I struggled through.
Yeah.
My first ever book was a book called Rabbit and Bear. And this is a book that my little boy got from Santa Claus on at Christmas. And again, his struggles with reading are very close to mine.
Well, let's talk about that. First of all, congratulations on reading that. And I don't mean that in a cynical or flippant way at all. It's a massive achievement, and it hopefully puts you on the road to further literacy and ability to grapple with it. But your son Ben is another reason we wanted to talk to you this morning, because he also has dyslexia.
He does.
And I don't know if it's genetic. I mean, or hereditary, or whatever the word might be. But when did you realise he had the same issues?
Well, again, you know, he started off in Montessori and he was wonderful. And then he went to school in Holly Park Boys School.
Yeah,
a fantastic school. We were thrilled about that. And he was doing great. It's funny, he was so interested. He used to come home at night after school and sit his little 3-year-old sister down like she was the student and he was the teacher.
You're telling him. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And he loved it.
Yeah.
So he progressed very well in junior infants and so on and so forth. And I think in senior infants, they started to say, listen, we're not quite sure. There's a couple of little things we noticed here.
Okay.
Obviously, my wife, or you know, I hadn't noticed anything, or my wife was maybe reading with him, maybe she'd noticed some things. So we took the decision to go and get him assessed when he started in first class. And so he was diagnosed with severe dyslexia. He's a very high IQ, but he's severely dyslexic. And reading is really, really challenging for him, like me.
Yes.
And so we were. It was recommended to us that we try and get him into one of the reading schools, and
to remind you, he's 9 years old.
He's 9 years old now. Yeah,
and you said he's got a high IQ, and he sounds like a great
he
kid.
He's a great little boy. Yeah.
Did the dyslexia, once it was diagnosed, does it do things to your confidence, yours or his, or were you able to learn, or teach from your experience?
Yeah. I mean, he's a very bright little guy, and he loves, you know, he's very fun loving, and he's very interested in a lot of things. And if he captures something that he's interested in, there's no stopping him.
Okay.
But as far as reading is concerned, and homework and spellings, you know, that was difficult, you know, and my wife found that very difficult. And again, it would be like me, he would have rebelled against it and not wanted to be involved in it at all. And we found homework very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And indeed, the school, were really, really good. Really, really good, I must say. But they can only do so much with the resources they have. And he was in a special class for an hour or something like that, with some other boys, I must add, in the school, and who had reading difficulties and so on and so forth. But they really were great to help, and they were involved in this decision process and all that kind of stuff as to whether we were going to move them.
There was no sense that any child was left behind.
No.
But this brings us neatly enough to the reading school. Now, this is a phenomenon I did not know about until I was invited to go to one and speak to the parents and or at least the teachers and children there a few years ago. Would you explain to us what it is in theory?
Yeah, it's a very small. Careful, I don't make the wrong words, but it's a very targeted approach to children's needs. And in our particular school, excuse me, it's focused for children with severe dyslexia.
Yeah.
Now, each class, there's about 8 or 9 students in a class, and they have this particular program called the Wilson Reading. It's a 12-step program to teach kids. And my understanding of it, I might add here, you know, that to a certain extent, I've stepped back from the understanding of how it works, because I struggle with same. And ironically, my little boy is taking interest in trying to teach me
good
the Wilson ways and so on, hence the rabbit and bear.
Okay.
It's a very, very small class, and they're very targeted to go back to basics and teach children how to read and teach children. For me and for Ben, you know, most children are taught via phonics, and phonics makes, I suppose, an answer to your earlier question I couldn't come up with, but phonics is a nightmare for me. I just can't understand.
This is where if you spell the word shop, it's up.
Yeah. And then there's tricky words in this, and that's where he struggled, and that's where I struggle. So the school is extremely attentive. I must say I was relatively sceptical when this was pushed towards us, but he's there about 5 months now, and that's why I wrote in, because I'm extremely impressed with the progress, and I was sceptical.
And he leaves his own school.
He does.
For 2 years.
Yes, for 2 years.
And he's in this particular school, the reading school. There are 3 of them in Dublin.
Yes.
Oh, sorry, three in Ireland, I know. That,
three in Ireland, that's correct.
And they're very limited space and huge demand, obviously.
Yeah.
And
we were very lucky to get the place, and that was really, you know, Everybody that's spoken to us about this. I mean, we had a long process. We had nearly 2 years to decide whether we were going to go in for this. I mean, we had a year, certainly, since we got awarded the place. And the places are very, very hard to get.
And 5 months in, Gordon, how's he doing? Is he, have you noticed the difference? His confidence, his ability to read, etc.?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, again, there's the rabbit and bear where he's taken an interest. Homework, he's taken an interest.
Right.
And I must say, I'm dying to... see him in 2 years' time when he goes back into school and kind of see how he's progressed and how well he sits back into school. And but he has progressed really, really well. And I mean, only just a week ago, we were brought into school for, they have this art week, and every class, you know, they take on a small project, all the individual students, for art. And they all paint these pictures, and they all have to kind of do a presentation on their artist. And, you know, for Ben, my little boy, for me to stand up at nine in front of 62 other children and a load of parents and make a speech, albeit written on card that he'd probably written, was so impressive to me. Yeah. I never thought he'd do that. I mean, I wouldn't do that now. Like, I've never done a reading in a church because at Mass or anything like that, because I'd be terrified about it.
It's a funny thing, but, you know, even dyslexia or otherwise, public speaking is terrifying for people.
Yeah.
In the school I was in yesterday, I said to the children, you know, put up your hand if you have a question. And I always keep an eye on the ones who don't put up the hand.
Yeah.
Because I always say, and I said, look, those of you who didn't put up your hand, don't be worried about it, because it's actually quite terrifying for you. Because the question I've been asked was, do you get nervous presenting the Late Late Show? And I said, yeah, because I do. I always get, the nerves fuel your excitement, I suppose. And so it's perfectly normal. I think that's the thing about public speaking and nervousness, is not to tell people you shouldn't be so nervous. Of course you should. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's not as terrifying once you're up there. In some ways.
Yeah.
But we'll get you there eventually, Gordon. I'll tell you. Here's some text coming in. I have dyslexia. I'm in my 60s. I spend hours writing out spelling, which I'd never be any better at. I love my home parish, but I go into severe anxiety when people there who are in schools meet show up, and I still believe they look down on me and how stupid I was. And now I end up waffling. That's a pity because, as you said, you're Ben, high IQ, dyslexia. Not a stupid child. And I don't think there's any such thing as a stupid child anyway.
Absolutely.
The stupid adults.
Yeah, yeah.
And my daughter says the text was diagnosed with dyslexia in second class. And once she was diagnosed, things started to get better for her. Her teachers have been amazing and her reading is coming on all the time. She loves audiobooks and they are a great way for her to read at the same level as their peers and keep the interest in books. Thankfully, there are so many audiobooks available and tools. You mentioned that and apps and so on today. And I'll take another one from a Kildare listener who says it's great that dyslexia is being highlighted on the show this morning. I have two daughters who have it, one diagnosed in primary school, one in secondary. They both have got great support in school and college. My eldest is working in what she loves. And my other daughter is doing great in college. I'm certain I am myself, but have never been diagnosed both. My daughters are gifted in sport and music and thrive in this. Don't worry. They all find their path and get on in life. So that's useful. Thanks for highlighting this topic. Another says, Gordon is describing our troubles with our daughter, says Jules. Phonics nearly broke us. And while she was in the infants classes, she was up in the middle of the night with nerves, and now in third class she's exhausted from trying to keep up. So what do you say to her? I wonder. It's tough keeping up
yeah,
and it's tricky, but they should stay at it. My daughter Sienna is in her second year in a reading school in Tallis, says Amy. Sienna has gotten as far as second class in the mainstream school and literally couldn't read or write in the last year and a half in St. Rose's. The change in Sienna has been amazing, but not only her ability to read, but it has given her the confidence she deserves. We need to save these schools. Is there a threat to the reading schools?
Yeah, I suppose that's reason why I wrote in here.
Yeah, sure.
You know? I believe there's an NCSE report. I haven't read the report. My wife read it to me.
Okay.
And there's talk about removing these schools. And that's why I contacted the show.
Sure.
Because at the end of the day, I think for me, you know, I have the benefit through Ben and I can see that. But my concern is that these will go and they'll cease to be a part of the school setup that we need. And again, what I want to see is, you know, there's people turned away every year to try and get into this.
Oh,
we were one of the very, very lucky ones. And that's why we were told you must take this place if you get this place.
Yes.
And again, I go back to it. I was sceptical, but I'm not anymore. I can see the progress.
You've seen the light.
Well, I have.
Yeah.
But what upsets me is the fact that so many children don't have the opportunity. I often wonder to myself, more so now in the last in the last couple of months what I might have been able to do or what I might have been able to achieve, how my life would have gone a different way if I'd been given the tools, you know, to go back in and then be able to perform properly, you know, throughout school and finish. Well,
it's important to say, I was thinking about this, the sliding doors of, in your case, literacy.
Yeah.
If you mightn't have ended up in the business you're in.
True,
you're in a successful business.
Yes,
you employ 30 people.
I do,
you have a beautiful wife and gorgeous children. If you had been a great reader with all the abilities, you could have gone on a different carriage.
Yeah.
You know, so true. The world falls, the cards fall where they fall.
Maybe true, yeah, maybe true.
So I wouldn't be inclined to be regretful, but wistful
not.
Certainly.
Yeah.
But
I'm not, but I suppose I wonder and I'm looking forward to seeing how Ben progresses through his life and what he can
precisely,
do.
Precisely,
there's certainly things that I suppose I think, I mean, look, I'm 40 and I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up. I just wonder, there was things that I wanted to do and trying to achieve. And I mean, you know, I remember filling out the CAO form and thinking that, you know, I was going to do this. And of course, it was very wishful thinking. I might have been a magnificent doctor that I wasn't able to be. But, and indeed, I'm very thankful for the life I have. And I'm very, very lucky and very fortunate.
And did you stay in the car business? Is that what
I did? Yeah, I did. And I've again, you know, in my business life, same as there's probably a few people who know me now listening in who are sentences of, that's why he never takes any notes in the meetings.
There
and
you
that's
go.
Why he never brings any books in. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I managed to, I suppose I left the car dealership when it started to become difficult for me, when I started to have to fill in forms and write down addresses of customers and read certain things to people. And then I started my own business with a bucket and sponge and I've managed to move on. And again, I talk, I don't email. I send about 50 emails a year and they're small.
Yeah, they're brief
small
and
emails,
to the point.
Exactly,
that makes sense.
But it's something for me to see Ben and to see Ben come back to me with the Wilson book and try to teach me and take an interest in me as a grown up.
It's a great turnout for the books. There's a petition online if people want to support keeping these wonderful reading schools, which is my.uplift.ie, and you'll find petition there for Save Our Reading Schools. Breda was on to say my granddaughter is dyslexic and her mother found a particular font on the Amazon Kindle that is dyslexic friendly. How about that? It's been a great help. The only difference that I can see is that the bottom of the words are shaded darker than the top and the spaces between letters is a little bigger, and it may be of help to people. The font is called Open Dyslexic Font. Are you familiar with this font?
Yeah, my operations manager, he sends me emails in this font. It's somewhat helpful,
It's a good effort. My 9-year-old is in a reading class since September. It feels like we won the lotto. It's amazing. Husband was diagnosed a few months after our son, just like you, as his symptoms resonated so much with him. Reading schools rock. We should have one in every community. There's a lot of feedback on this topic. Miles Duffy is in Doolin. He says, our son Jamie has dyslexia and is doing his mock leaving cert at the moment. He knows all his stuff. Very clever. He can get help such as a reader, scribe, laptop, etc., which is great. But all he needs is a little more time. Another half hour will make all the difference for him to read and digest the answers. Why, oh, why can't the Department of Education just give these wonderful children that extra time? It's all they need.
That's a great point.
Gordon, it's been great to see you. And thanks for coming in and speaking so frankly about your story, because it's a corner of the education world we don't know probably a huge amount about in mainstream as such. But we wish you and Ben and, of course, Lauren and Gordon Jr. All the best in everything you do. And thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks a lot, Ryan.
Not at all. Gordon Goodwin joining us live in studio this morning. And the text number is always 51551. It's 10 to 10. Gabby, good morning to you.
Good morning, Ryan.
You wrote this lovely piece in the Irish Independent that caught our eye because we're a fan of the written word in the programme here.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
Letters, which are without doubt a dying art because texts and online. The
Unfortunately,
obvious,
the yeah.
Opposite. But your story intrigues because you weren't born in Ireland.
No.
Tell us where you were born.
So originally I'm from Lithuania and I moved here when I was 8 years of age. So that's why I've lived in Roscommon for a long time. That's why I have a Roscommon accent. As you
okay.
can tell.
And why did you leave Lithuania? Was it just...
Well, I suppose it was just, you know, it was during the recession and there was a lot of obviously migration and that. And we moved over. My dad moved over, my sister moved over, then me and my mum.
Okay, so the whole gang there. And are your family still based in Roscommon?
They are, yes. Yeah, yeah. My sister lives over in Holland, but my parents are still in Roscommon.
Are still here. Okay, and let me ask you then about your grandparents, because this is really where your story is at.
Yes.
Talk to me about you never met your granddad.
So my maternal granddad, I never met him. He died the year before I was born. And I was always told stories of how great he was, how kind he was. You know, he was a very nice man. He was a vet, so he was very educated. He was a doctor. And this past summer, I was visiting my grandmother. I visit her every year whenever I'm in Lithuania. And yeah. she hands me this blue folder, which I have here in front of me. And it was full of old letters.
Can I hold it?
Yeah, of course, Sky. You can have a look at it.
It's a really tattered museum piece. Yeah. And what does it say on the front of it, in Lithuanian?
So it says Ataskaita, which I understand is just a bunch of statements. You know, it was nothing interesting.
Random sort of.
Random bits and pieces. And
so, the other things?
So I think that's just the address.
Oh, I see.
Of, yeah, so if it was lost, you could return it.
So what did your grandmother say when she handed you this dusty old folder?
So she said, listen, you know, I know you're a writer. You might do something with this. This is few letters that your granddad's girlfriends sent him before we even met.
Girlfriends.
So there's letters in there from three different women.
From what era are we talking
so
about?
So this is from, I believe, is 1955 to 58. So a long time ago now. And so before he even met my grandmother, when he was in his early 20s, when he was in college training to be a vet, obviously how you communicate with people is by writing letters. And she said, yeah, I didn't know the folder. She knew the folder existed, but she didn't know what was in it when he was alive. And it was when he died, she kind of went through stuff, found the folder, and they're all love letters. And she went, wow. And she held on to it and she said, listen, you're right, you might be able to do something with it. And I suppose I have my story in the Irish Independent there on Wednesday. So I did something with it in the end.
Yeah, you did. But and it's so lovely to have the original letters. I'm holding them here. And so I love old documents like this because it brings you right back.
Yeah.
The top right hand corner of the page, as it always should be, is the date.
Yes. Yeah.
And they do a very interesting thing with the months, which is still done by some people, which is the Roman numerals for the months. So you can see IX and X depending on what month of the year it is. And maybe the venue for the address, I should say. Well, let's go through your granddad's ex-girlfriends then. I mean, there's three of them. This is a busy man and a very attentive man when it comes to keeping records of his past romances. Who will we begin with?
So there's three different women. Yeah. So it's Joanna, Adele and Stepa.
Well, so Joanna then, tell us about, what can we glean from the letters?
Yeah, so I suppose the one thread they all have in common, they're all excellent writers. And Joanna always starts off her letters and she describes where she's and what she's doing. So she might be, you know, it's Sunday evening, might be sitting on the couch and there's birds singing outside and she writes that down. So she's a beautiful writer.
Literary twists, yeah.
Very much so. You know, very honest. She tells them about her day, you know, if she's in college, what she did in college, or, you know, if she misses him, she says she misses him, of course. I think I believe it was Adele that he wrote to or was it Stepa? I can't remember now. Yeah,
who got the longest run out.
I believe that she wrote for 2 years.
Okay.
And, you know, very, very clear that she was very fond of him. And, you know, that she would give out to him if he didn't rock up on the Sunday to see her. She'd say, you know, I waited for you and you didn't come. And, you know, where were you? And I was waiting for your letter and I didn't get it. And I believe one of the letters even has, you know, one of the women questions, you know, why did you break things off with me in a letter, which I believe is a 1950s version of breaking up through text.
Yes. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So, you know, they're very honest. And it's like if you picked up the phone, what would you say? If you wrote a text, what would you say? It's the same. Obviously, we're much faster now in the digital age. You know, I don't go into so much detail when I text, you know, any of my friends or my partners, but it's just a very insightful read. They're very personal, they're very heartfelt, and it's just an incredible insight to this, you know, to who Granddad really was, you know, apart from the stories that my mother or my grandmother tells me, you know, who he really was when he was
allowed. Well, Gabby, these letters these are all one way.
Yeah.
These are from the girls writing to the boy.
Yes.
So what can we tell about your grandfather from one-way traffic?
Well, one-way traffic, I mean, it is probably a little bit biased. You know, I'm sure he was very good and he wrote back to every single...
No doubt. No ghosting was harmed in the making of this correspondence.
No ghosting. I mean, it would be great to see what he wrote back. But, you know, like, they were certainly very open and honest with him. And, you know, they're very heartfelt and just, you know, they said what was on their mind and they didn't, you know, they didn't disguise any of it. It was very, just very truthful. I suppose that was a common theme throughout all of the letters, really.
The radio documentary that's been waiting to be made is you tracking down the three women and finding out whatever happened to them. Wouldn't that be a beautiful thing?
It would
be
great.
Letters from my grandfather. I can hear the ads already for it.
I know.
But it would be fascinating. Yeah. Do we have much details as to the addresses and the provenance of the letters and where they're from, the women?
So all we have, I think, is a few vague addresses. Yeah. Obviously, you know, they would be probably in their 80s now, so maybe some of them might have passed on. But listen, I'll find a few minutes when I'm not out reporting and I'll see if I can track down something.
Well, it's the beginning of the stories. Is there a common theme in what the women were writing to your grandfather?
Yeah, so I know one of them was in college with him, so she talks most about college and I believe they go and they do sort of like work practices, so she talks about that and going in and training to be a vet. But if you picked up the phone to your, you know, partner and said, you know, rang them once a week, and you'd say, well, Monday I did this, Tuesday I did that, and you know, their feelings about it all, and you know, they're very honest, and it's funny to see, like, they go to obviously dances and stuff as well, and they go to the cinema, and you know, so it's nice to see that.
Isn't it similar? It's kind of funny, yeah, it's similar, as you say. This is 1958 and thereabouts, 56 to 58, and really looking through what you've been writing about, there's not a huge difference between 50s romance and 1950s romance and 2020s romance.
Well, the love stays the same, doesn't it?
And yeah, well, you still admire the nature, and you still admire you still want to go to the cinema, and you know,
of course,
it's not dramatic. Now, I presume we'll talk about this on the later on about the state of online dating, but that's a different world altogether. There's something very elegant and civilized about this world.
Well, it's a great keepsake to have. I mean, to have the letters there in front of you to be showing them to Mr. Ryan Tubridy, really, obviously, you know, it's great just to have them, and it's something that I'm going to pass on to, you know, my own grandchildren. But I suppose the sad thing about it is that it'll be my granddad's letters that I pass on and not my own, because I don't write letters and I've never written a love letter. And I couldn't imagine sitting down, writing a letter and posting it for my partner to open it up. It would just be mortifying.
Really? This is the thought of it?
Absolutely. I mean, could you imagine? It's just, it'd be so cringeworthy, and just being so honest, and it's just, I personally couldn't imagine doing it.
You're more Irish now than you are Lithuanian.
Well, this maybe my accent I am.
No, but just the cringe of being emotional on paper.
That's actually a good point. Lithuanians are very honest and heartfelt, and they're very straight with you. Or they're obviously Irish people are maybe a little bit, maybe they won't say what they really think sometimes. Yeah. So maybe I have gotten some of that.
So when you go home to your granny, she might say, God, what's wrong with you? You look tired, or you know, you're not happy. What's wrong? As opposed to, we dance around it here. Is that how you notice the cultural differences?
Say, well, would you like a cup of tea? And my grandmother would say, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, absolutely. She can smell it a mile away, I can say.
Very much.
What does
so.
She make of you being Irish now? I mean, you're Irish Lithuanian, obviously, but does she find it bizarre? Do you talk only in Lithuanian to her?
Yeah, so I communicate to all of my family in Lithuanian. Listen, she's my grandmother and she loves me very much.
Of course,
and
she does.
You know, I'm still very much Lithuanian when I am in that setting. I don't have an accent when I speak in Lithuanian. You know, I ring her and I see her as often as I can, but she's a very strong lady. She's very, you know, she's very feisty, I think, which is probably maybe where I get a little bit of my own courage. But listen, a lot of families emigrated. I was one of them. And as long as we keep in touch, that keeps her happy.
There's a big Lithuanian community in Ireland, I presume.
There is, yes, there is. So my parents would have a lot of Lithuanian friends, and we all kind of try and stick together. But we've definitely merged into the
Irish. And what part of that country was your grandfather writing, or did he train to be a vet in?
Yeah, so I believe it was Klaipeda, which is a coastal town. It's beautiful. It's just beside the Baltic Sea. Mm. That's where he was trained to be a vet. So, yeah, I think one of the photographs that we had actually when the story was published in yesterday's Herald was actually a photograph of him. And at the bottom it said Klaipeda, which is great to have as well.
So you have all that. And it just remind me, do you have vague details of where the girls came from that sent the letter? That's all. You've no specific addresses?
Well, we have kind of very vague addresses. I believe Šilutė is another town in Lithuania as well that's kind of mentioned there, which is actually where my mother is originally from. So they're just very vague towns is kind of all we have.
And do you have the second names of the girls?
No,
just of the course. First Why name. Would they? They know who'd sign their second name on that thing. That's interesting. Yes, so that's going to make it a little bit trickier. I love the letter where they said, where you can see the arc of the relationship disintegrating. Mm. You can see the blossom of love And then the sort of boredom or the ennui setting in, obviously, and then the farewell sort of, she's starting to get a bit fed up. You were saying that the sign-offs go from love you to... get back to me.
See you later. Yeah. Well, it was interesting because I believe they kind of started corresponding just looking at the dates in the summer, and that's when their love really blossomed, and it was nice and warm. And obviously, as the temperatures rose, so did the relationship. And then when the cold weather set in, the relationship kind of wilted away, and it went from "I love you" and "I'll see you soon" to just "Okay, need write back soon," or just that kind of. And you can tell, obviously, it's very easy to tell from looking at all of the letters now. Listen, I'm sure my grandmother never wrote my granddad one letter. So I think that's why she actually held on to
them. Say that again. You're what?
She never wrote him one letter.
Your grandmother never wrote?
No. So I think that's part of the reason why she held on to the folder. Because she was like, listen, all these women wanted him, and yet I got him.
This is her scalp. And had she read all these letters? She must have. I mean,
I don't think she has.
I don't believe your grandmother. I'm sure she's gorgeous and amazing, but I can't believe that she had this folder of letters from, you know, what were essentially the competition down through the years, and that
this
she just left them alone.
She said, yeah, like, they were trying to get him. They didn't get him. I got him.
They're well-thumbed, Gabby.
So, listen, I mean, all the more power to her.
Yeah. She got her man in the end.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, they're beautiful letters, and thank you so much for
sharing them with me.
I love these old documents, and it's a treasure for you, treasure trove. I think it's the beginning of an adventure, actually, for you, if you were to be extra curious and get busy, turning this into something else, if you wanted to. Or you could just leave it as it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's a great old story. It's amazing, says a text from Rebecca in Roscommon, to hear a Lithuanian Irish accent on the radio. all the Irish people speak with mid-Atlantic horrendous accents, and hers is gorgeous.
Thank you very much, Rebecca.
I'd agree with that, too.
A fellow Rossi.
I've got you really fully in the picture now. But Gabby, thanks for coming to see us. Tell us your second name so I don't mangle it.
Gata Vetskaitia.
Gata Vetskaitia.
That's a good job.
We'll take that. Okay, Gabby, nice to see you. And thanks for sharing those gorgeous letters with us. And tell your granny we appreciated that insight too. It's very kind of her. All right, 22 minutes to 10.